So in light of our just returning from the feast, I thought I would continue the feast theme in the sermon today. So some of you who are here stayed for Bible study will recognize the topic because we kind of got into it within 20 minutes of starting. The weather, the power went out, and then that was it for us. So no more of that. So we're going to talk about it today, but in more of a sermon type of thing. There were things that I thought about as far as agriculture in the future and what it will be like after Christ's return. And when we went through the Bible study, the first part of it, we talked about how that man was cursed, and because of the sin of Adam and Eve, they sinned and there were curses placed upon them. And as far as Adam is concerned, because he ate of the forbidden fruit, we know that God said to him, because you heeded the voice of your wife, this is in Genesis chapter 3, verse 17, and have eaten from the tree which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. So agriculture was going, and producing food was going to be much more difficult than it was if they had eaten of the tree of life and followed the path that God laid out for them. They rejected that path and chose their own path, and as a result of that, God said, life is going to be more difficult for you. And to point out that you are under a curse, then growing crops and all of that is going to be hard, and there are going to be difficulties with it. And when you're done with all of that hard work and that sweat and toil, you will return to the earth from which you were formed. So they were cursed, and we talked about the flood. And after the flood, man's been wiped out. Eight people survive. And I'd like to go to Genesis chapter 8 and begin in verse 20. And it just to clarify something that is brought out in these verses. Chapter 8, verse 20, and down through verse 22. It says, then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. So the flood is over. Noah is able to get off the ark, and he offers up, makes an offering to God. And the Lord smelled a soothing aroma. Then the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake. Although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, nor will I again destroy every living thing as I have done. So it seems there was, you know, there's a couple of ways you can go with this verse. And I think, as you'll see, one is more correct than the other. It was said that this applied to removing the curse of man that was placed upon man as far as tilling the ground. But is that what that verse says? It says in verse 22, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, and day and night shall not cease. So God's said, no more, talked about no more curse. But what does that mean? Does that apply to removing the curse that was placed on man when he sinned in the garden? You know, he ate of the tree that he was not supposed to in the garden, or does that apply to the flood? Well, just a couple of comments here. First of all, the first comment is from Adam Clark, and on the phrase, I will not again curse the ground. His view is, he says, I will not add to the curse to curse the ground. There shall not be another deluge to destroy the whole earth. For the imagination of man's heart, although the imagination of man's heart should be evil, and that's the way it's continued to be. Man's heart did not change after the flood. Man's heart continued to be evil, but God said, no matter how evil it got, I am not going to destroy the earth again with a flood. And that's what he's referring to there when he says no more curse, because destroying all mankind was a curse. And God said, I'm not going to curse man in that way any longer. In fact, as you look forward, God is going to flood the earth at the end with not a flood of water, but fire. The entire earth is going to be burned up, and the world as we know it as God comes to an end of working with human beings, he's going to burn it up with with fire, as we find in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 7. And then if you look at Barnes' notes, he says the closing sentence of this verse, which is verse 21, is a reiteration in a more explicit form of the same promise. Neither will I again smite all living as I have done. There will be no repetition of the flood or the deluge that had just overswept the land and destroyed its inhabitants. So I thought I would clarify that, since there was some question about what that meant, and clarify it for everyone. In the 20th century, man has instituted mechanized farming. As you look at the 20th century, as it unfolded, there was breakthrough after breakthrough in farming methods. You had mechanization, you had steam power, then you had gas, and man was able to do more with all of these mechanized, with tractors and threshers and all of that kind of thing, able to do more than he had ever done before, bring in a harvest faster and more efficiently than ever before. And so people were able to plant more extensively. People were able to do a lot of things that they could not do before. It was all hard work, and for most of man's history, you get out there with a shovel and a hoe, and you've seen people scraping the ground there, pushing it through the ground in order to till it. They couldn't do the deep plowing like you could do with a horse or a mule. And, just coming up with a plow, which we may see as pretty primitive, was a massive breakthrough for human beings. And interestingly, the Amish in Ohio at least farm with the plow and a horse. And so you see the man behind there and pulling that plow and tilling up the ground. And, I thought, I bet at the end of the day, he's not going to want to go into town and run around and all of that. I don't think that's, you plow all day. You're tired. You're ready to just stay, eat supper and go home. We also learned something about farming in Alberta and Saskatchewan from two different individuals that grew up on farms in Canada. When they were farming and they came in to eat, you had 10 minutes to eat. These are two separate families, 10 minutes to eat, and it was then back on the job. So I thought, 10 minutes to eat? I mean, all you're doing is bending over and shoveling the food in, and then you're back out the door and doing whatever job you were doing. And I thought, wow, you guys are harsh. So anyway, that's how it was there. And, the one guy was a younger man, and he said, those were the best years of my life. I always remember them. I'm thinking, man, that was like being under, really a rigid regime. But they, they thrived and did well. And a lot of the people there were hardworking people. I know one lady said she, she's in her 80s, and she said, I love driving the thresher, the threshing machine, the combine, and all of that. But she said, in my 80s, they won't let me drive anymore, so she can't be on that anymore. Her son won't let her. But she enjoyed it while she had the opportunity. So it was interesting to see, people that were back from that hardworking background, and they lived under some harsh conditions in some of those places, and farming wasn't easy. But we see that in the 20th century, farming became easier, and you were able to work more efficiently and produce more. Just using human skills, they have been able to modify and crossbreed and genetically modify seeds. And that's not doing anything wrong with them, but taking what's there and being able to crossbreed it with other plants and modify it in different ways. I mean, if you look at the potatoes, they originated in South America. And if you look at potatoes in South America, they're these little tiny potatoes. And then as you see them developed, we get these big monster potatoes, that we get at the salad bars and all of that. But they've been able to modify them, and I'm not sure about why you get big potatoes, but they've been able to do things that allow the big potatoes to come. But they've all now begun to modify seeds in ways that were not just normal. You've been able to push the envelope and break through with genetic cloning and genetic modification in ways that God never intended. And, when you step back and you say the creator of the universe planned all this out and created it in a certain way, and he allowed modification within certain limits. But when you push beyond those limits, what are the consequences? And I think we see some of those consequences in things today. We have one of the big challenges is, if you've ever grown up on a farm, one of the challenges is weeds. Weeds grow up in your garden, weeds grow up in your field, and you have to go out there and old-fashioned, you had to go and march up and down the rows and get the weeds out. I know that I always felt sorry for my cousins who had to go work in their garden, which tomatoes and cucumbers and all those kinds of things. So they had to go out there and spend time every day in the garden, which I thought, man, you've got a harsh. Your mom is a harsh taskmaster. I'm thinking at 5 and 6 and 7, and I didn't have to do that, which I was thankful for. Probably would have done me some good, but I was not on that page at the time because I was ready to go play. Working in the garden is not fun. So fun was my MO at the time. But anyway, you had to cut down the weeds. You had to try to keep the weeds from overtaking the plants so you would get a good harvest. So not only do you have weeds, you have pests that get in there, and the boll weevils here in Texas, and you have to get rid of them. So man's come up with pesticides, so things that he can spray on the plants and around the plants that will kill the bugs. And man's also come up with herbicides. Probably one that we're quite familiar with is known as Roundup. So Roundup is effective at killing the weeds. However, the problem with that has come about, and somebody was telling me this at the feast. He said that the weeds are no longer impacted by Roundup. And Roundup doesn't do it anymore. And they had modified the seed so you could spray them with Roundup, which usually will kill any and everything, but they'll survive the Roundup. But now they can't get rid of the weeds, and so they've had to go to something even more toxic. And the fellow was saying that they've started to spray it on the fields, and the plants survive. However, and it does kill the weeds, but it's also killed all the trees. If even a little tiny bit gets on a tree, that tree's a goner. So it's pretty potent. So you think, wait a minute, we're spraying this on? What's the long-term impact of that? So we don't know. We're trying that. But your man is able to modify a plant to where you can spray it with an herbicide and it won't affect it. But it will kill all the weeds around it. So if they were the way they should be, it will kill everything, that stuff that you're spraying on there. But man is able to do things that allow him to produce more, but I'm not sure the long-term prospect is good. Livestock. Livestock used to be raised in small numbers for the most part, and they used to be grass-fed. Grass-fed was not an unusual thing if you went back far enough. But man said, well, we can produce more, we can produce it faster, bigger, and all of this. So he's implemented various things to be able to do that. So you're able to buy a hamburger for a certain price at this point, which is fairly close to the price many years ago. And how have they been able to do that? They've had to implement things that allow you to produce more at a less cost, which may not be good for our health. So anyway, and I was just, if you look at feedlots, I used to drive by a feedlot every day when I went to school in California. Whew, on hot days, it was an unpleasant place to drive by. If you go by a chicken barn, these massive chicken barns, and it's got to be hot in there. And what everybody wants with a chicken is what? A great big chicken breast. That's what they want. So what happens is they bred them so they have huge breasts, but they can't stand up. So their legs break and they can't stand up because the breast is so large. And that may not be exactly how God wanted it to be. And we use antibiotics and they're cloning various animals and genetically modifying them. I was looking at a picture of a horse that they've genetically modified, and the horse does not look like a normal horse. It's got all the sculpting around its face and all of that. And I'm not sure that's going to work out well either. And they're doing that with not only horses but other animals, because they're going to create the perfect animal. If it's a horse or it's a sheep or whatever, they're going to make it perfect based upon what people want, and designer animals. So anyway, that's the things that man can do. We also have a lot of our food that's irradiated, and that helps it to last longer. But is it good for us? And so we're in a condition now where we can produce a lot of meat, a lot of eggs, dairy, but is it good for us? We can produce lots of fruits and vegetables, but are they good for us? Are they nutritionally sound that help to build our bodies? Lots of grain, but is it the best for us? In our time, some amazing things have been done in regard to irrigation. And this is actually, I don't know whether it's positive. It seems to be positive. I read a book about called Let There Be Water, and it's about Israel and water. They told the people that settled Israel that you could only fit so many people into that land because it would not sustain a larger population. Because it's Israel is a dry land, and you depend upon the rain. And if you don't get the rain, you can't grow crops. And there's only so much water that you can use for irrigation. So if you look at it just from a limited point of view, you can only do so much. But the Israelis looked at the situation and said, you know what, we want lots of people of our ethnic background to be living here in Israel. So how can we accomplish that? So they've made all sorts of breakthroughs with irrigation, and they're able to do not irrigation like in Egypt, which was you got water from the Nile and you flooded the areas around the plants, and that you were dependent upon the Nile for that, and you had lots of that water along the edge of the Nile River. And if you look at the Nile is this narrow strip, and out from it on both sides you find green where people can live, and you go beyond that green strip, what is there out there? Desert, wasteland, nothing grows there. So if you can get the water to it, it'll produce crops, but if you can't get the water to it, you can't produce anything. And but Israel was not that kind of a land where you could rely on a river to provide water for you to cultivate the crops. So you depended on God. But what the Israelis have done is they found ways to make the most use of water, and they're able to use a little bit of water to irrigate their crops, but it's drip irrigation. And so they've been able to use that and produce, you know, crops in the desert and do it in an efficient way. And really, you know, if we were to do that, do drip irrigation for our gardens or our lawns and all of that, you would use water more efficiently. And they had to come up with ways to do it efficiently because they didn't have that much. But they wanted to make it possible for more people to live there. So God is aware of that and the need for water in order to produce crops, and we'll see how God's going to work that out as we look at move on to the future, to that time that's pictured during the 1,000 years when Christ will reign. So let's begin in Isaiah chapter 11. Isaiah chapter 11. Isaiah 11, beginning in verse 6. One of the fundamental things that's going to change as Christ returns is a very different spirit, which will produce very different results than we have today. And we see beginning in chapter 11, verse 6, it says, "The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb. The leopard shall lie down with the young goat, the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them." So that's not the way it is today. But it will be in that time. "The cow and the bear shall graze. Their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox." You know, if you have cattle or sheep or goats, you're not going to have to put like many people now have learned to put a donkey in with those animals, because the donkey will kick, they're territorial, so they'll protect the animals that are in there and kick the daylights out of coyotes and wolves and other predators that may come among the sheep, and they will protect them. So they've got a pretty nasty kick, so don't ever get behind a donkey and disturb him, because they can kick and it is awfully painful. So there will be a different spirit, a different nature. The nursing child shall play by the cobra's hole, and the weaned child shall put his hand in the viper's den. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my mountain. You know, so if you own, you have cattle grazing or sheep grazing, you're not going to have to worry about predators coming in and savaging your flock. It's not going to happen. They're going to be able to graze. They're going to be able to feed. And there will not be that outcome. They will neither hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. And the picture is much wider than just animals in the field. Much more substantial than that. But we get an inkling of what will happen, because there's going to be a different spirit there. The last part of the verse says, "For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." So everybody will know who God is. Everybody will acknowledge God. And there are fruits to that acknowledgement and acting upon that, because it won't just be like Satan and the demons. They believe God exists. They know He exists. And they're quite aware of that. But they have no interest in cooperating with God. None. And they are His adversaries and will always be God's adversaries until God said, "Enough, you guys are done and gone forever." "For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." And there's a beautiful outcome where you acknowledge God and His way of life and begin to live that way. And that's going to be the difference there. The spirit of the world will be gone. And the Spirit of God will be the great influencer of everything that is done here on earth. And as you begin to do things in harmony and in cooperation with God, you automatically get different results, better results. You know, you're going to say, "You know what? This horse was created by God, and I think God knew what He was doing. So we can modify it because we want a different color or maybe a little bit bigger, but there's a limit, and we're willing to accept that limit. We don't have to say, 'You know what? I can do it better than God.' I don't think any of us can. I've not been able to. And usually when I try to do it my way, how's that work out? Not so well. Because we don't see the full picture like God does." Let's go to Hosea chapter 2. Hosea chapter 2. And the beauty of the scriptures is, you know, as we see from going to the feast, is that God gives us many insights into what is to come. Because He wants us to see it and see that it's a reality and think about it. What's it going to be like when this actually happens? Hosea chapter 2, and let's begin in verse 16. Hosea 2, verse 16. It says, "And it shall be in that day," and that is in the time when Christ will reign, "says the Lord, that you will call me my husband, and no longer shall call me my master." There's going to be a relationship between God and the people that is like a marriage. You know, we are the bride of Christ as the church. And people are going to be married to God and have that kind of an intimate, personal relationship as they interact with God. He said, "For I will take from her mouth the names of the Baals, and they shall be remembered by their name no more." So you're not going to have Baal. We're not going to be saying things like "holy moly." You know, what does "holy moly" mean? That means holy Molech. And is Molech holy? He's not. So all of those kinds of things that we refer to and people don't even think twice about, they're not going to be uttered. We're not going to have the name Baal around anymore. "In that day I will make a covenant with them, with the beast of the field and with the birds of the air and with the creeping things of the ground." He's going to make a covenant with them, with those beasts, with the birds of the air and with the creeping things of the ground. So when I put my garden out and I put tomatoes out there or I put strawberries out there, hopefully that covenant covers those plants that I put out, and they're no longer going to be eating them. God is going to make a covenant with them, and they will no longer be, you won't have locust swarms of locusts come through and wipe out your crops. You're not going to have the boll weevils. You're not going to have all of these insects that destroy our crops. You're not going to have the weeds and those kinds of things like that, the worms and the different things that get into our crops. Bow and sword of battle I will shatter from the earth to make them lie down safely. You're not going to have to worry about war. Think of people in Syria. How much agriculture is going on in Syria today as people battle? They battle one another. Their fields are destroyed. They live in fear. They've had to be uprooted from where they lived. And where do they go? How do you have a place to live, much less a garden or livestock? How do you do any of that? And that's the world in which we live, where there's this upheaval and people are driven from their homes, searching for places where they can live and live in peace. But that's what God promises. There's not going to be any more war and upheaval and the upset that happens. And once you can't grow crops, how do you earn money to buy food with? You've not produced anything, so where do you get the funds to be able to buy the food that you need? And is it even available? So you have all this upheaval that people go through and have gone through during man's entire history. And God said, this is coming to an end. He says in verse 19, I will betroth you to me forever. Yes, I will betroth you to me in righteousness and justice, in loving kindness and mercy. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord your God. And then he goes on to say, it shall come to pass in that day that I will answer, says the Lord, I will answer the heavens, and they shall answer the earth, and the earth shall answer with grain, with new wine, with oil. They shall answer Jezreel. And what does Jezreel mean? It means God sows. God sows. Then I will sow her for myself in the earth, and I will have mercy on her who had not obtained mercy. Then I will say to those who were not my people, you are my people, and they shall say, you are my God. A different spirit, a different attitude, and God is going to bless them. And God is going to make a covenant with the various creatures that impact agriculture and other facets of life, and there's going to be a different spirit there. You know, you're not going to have to worry about it. I know at Cochrane, people were saying that down in this valley, you know, we could walk from where we were staying into the town of Cochrane. And so we were going to do that. But somebody also told me, well, we've had a bear and a cougar down there. And I'm like, that could be interesting. We may really hot-foot it into town if that happens. So we didn't see a bear or a cougar when we walked down there. But people told us that, oh, yeah, we've had one down there. And there was a beaver down there as well. I thought of going down to see the beaver. Then I thought of the bear and the cougar. I thought, I'm not going to go down there by myself. So anyway, we decided that the nature of animals has not changed to this point. So maybe it would be imprudent for me to go down there. So anyway, God said, I'm going to produce, you're going to begin to prosper and enjoy the good things from planting your crops. And they will produce because I will be with you. I will be your God and you will be my people. There will be a completely different spirit among the people at that time. Let's go to and look at another verse that tells us about the difference in nature in Isaiah chapter 2. Isaiah chapter 2. And you know, as you look at these things, for some of us they're not new, some they are new, but they're worth going through and considering. And just thinking about, because we all long for that, the God's coming kingdom. What's it going to be like? What will be the qualities? And God tells us what the qualities will be. Not every detail, but he gives us enough of a picture to where we can say, this is going to happen. I can be a part of this. I want to be a part of this. And Isaiah chapter 2, beginning in verse 5. It says, the word that Isaiah, the son of chapter 2, verse 1, God is speaking to Isaiah, and he says in verse 2, now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house, the mountain of the Lord's house, that is God's kingdom, God's government, shall be established on the top of the mountains. He will be the ruler over all of these other mountains. His mountain will be supreme, so he'll be over the large nations and shall be exalted above the hills, the smaller nations. He will rule over them all, and all nations shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. So what does that have to do with agriculture? You know, as you look at that, it's telling you that God's law is going to be what governs everything. It's going to govern how you work. You're going to work 6 days. You're not going to work 7 days. You're going to plant your crops. You're going to work in your field for 6 days. And the seventh day, you're going to take off. And the beautiful thing is it won't just be in spotty around the earth. The whole earth will shut down. And as it says in Isaiah, later on in Isaiah, it says, from Sabbath to Sabbath, my Sabbath will be kept. Every week, people are going to shut down for the Sabbath and enjoy that time off and go to church in their communities. And God's law is going to be the guide for how you grow things. You're not going to try to shortcut things. You're not going to try to produce, get the ground to produce in a way that it shouldn't, or overtax the ground. We have misused the land that God has given us. You know, one of the blessings that God has given us from Texas on north up into Nebraska in place are these aquifers. And those aquifers have provided water that you could use for crops. But unfortunately, you keep draining the aquifers and they don't refill. And those aquifers are not there any longer. Or they're down to the bottom. And once they're gone, they're gone. So we've used them up. And there's no filling them up again that we know of at this point. Maybe somebody will come up with a way of doing that. But it says that God is going to judge between nations and rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Yes, it's going to be a world in which they're going to stop making weapons and they're going to begin making tools and implements that you can use in agriculture. So use to trim your vines, use to hoe your crops and to take care of those things in so that you produce a good crop. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. And as I said, war has been one of the great impediments to regular agriculture. And once you have war and it ravages your land, it takes a while for that to come back. And people are subject to famine, people are subject to disease, and God said, we're going to put a stop to that. And we're going to begin to produce implements that we can use for agriculture and produce things that are going to be healthy and nutritional for mankind. Let's go to Micah chapter 4. Micah chapter 4. And this tells us something interesting here. Now, I know that people have told me that Christ was a communist and Christ preached this communal living and we all own it together because they look at the book of Acts and all of that. Well, this would tend to refute that, that we all own everything in common. And he says, and not that that cooperation and all of that is wrong, but God tells you something different here. Let's look at Micah chapter 4. And look at verse 4. Micah 4, verse 4. It says, but everyone shall sit under his vine. Not under the commune's vine, but his vine. And under his fig tree. And no one shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken. And so he's saying that I'm going to give you a parcel of land. And when Christ returns, what he's going to do is he's going to establish his throne on Mount Zion. And he's going to dwell there on Mount Zion. A temple will be built there, and there will be a city there. And it's described for us in the scriptures. And we're told that the city, basically, in Isaiah chapter 48, is going to be 10 miles square. 10 miles on each side. And there will be a portion for the Levites. There will be a temple complex. And there will be places for the priest. There will be a place there called the city called the Lord is there. There will be a property of the city, Israel's portion, and land for the workers of the city to grow food. And so it's all organized. God tells you what it's going to be like. And we can have a glimpse of that and kind of think about, okay, what does that mean? How is that going to be structured? And, you know, he tells you how this is going to go. And so this is going to be basically in the middle of the land. And north of it, he's going to allocate areas for each of the tribes of Israel. So as you go north, you have Jerusalem, where the city of the king will be and the temple will be. And north of there, you're going to have, first of all, Judah. They're going to be given a portion of land. And then you're going to have Reuben north of that, Ephraim north of that, Manasseh north of that, Naphtali, Asher, and Dan to the far north. And they're all going to have their territory. And then south of Jerusalem, you'll have Benjamin, Simeon, Issachar, Zebulun, and Gad. And the Levites will be working in that city in God's service. And what's going to happen? So God's going to allocate a portion of land to each of the nations of Israel. And then what's he going to do? As it says in Micah, but everyone shall sit under his vine and his fig tree. So each of the nations of Israel will be given a portion of land, and then they will take a portion of land and a portion of that to each and every family in Israel. They will all have their portion of land. And God will give to each of them a place where they can plant their vines and their fig trees. And it will be theirs. And it will be theirs forever. You know, you remember back to Ahab wanted a portion of land that had been given to Naboth, had been given to him, and it had been given to him in the time of his family in the time of Joshua. It was his portion. And it was to be his portion forever. Ahab wanted it, and he wanted it so badly that, you know, when he wouldn't cave in and let him have it. Ahab, as an Israelite king, had no way to take it from this man. There was no legal way to do it that he knew as king. However, he was married to a non-Israelite who didn't operate within the bounds of God. And she said, what's wrong? You know, he's there pouting on the bed, and she notices that he's pouting. Well, what's wrong with you? Well, I want Naboth's property there, and he's not willing to sell it to me, and I offered him a good price and all that. And she said, let me take care of it. So basically, she came up with a way to murder, to falsely accuse him and execute him. Based upon the charges made against him, he could be executed. So they took his property. And if you look at that, what took place there, and you go continue on with the story, eventually there is a day of reckoning. God didn't forget that. You took this from this man and his family, and you're going to pay a price for that. What you did was beyond the pale. And they did pay the price for it. But the thing is, God is going to give each family a portion of land that will be theirs, and it will be theirs throughout the entire 1,000 years. Now, let's say that the weather turns bad, or they can't produce a crop, or they lose it for some reason. What happens then? We'll get to that a little bit later. Is there any hope, or is it gone forever? Let's go to Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 13. Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 13. So, God amazingly talks about the issues and things involved with farming throughout the scriptures. And he says in Zephaniah 3, verse 13, he says, the remnant of Israel shall do no unrighteousness and speak no lies, nor shall a deceitful tongue be found in their mouths. For they shall feed their flocks and lie down. They shall feed their flocks and lie down, and no one shall make them afraid. You know, if you are out in the field with your flocks today, even today, you have to contend with coyotes You have to contend with snakes. You have to contend with bear and all of the other predators. You have to deal with that. And that was the way it was in ancient times. And if you're a shepherd, you have to deal with that too, because predators know where they go where the food is. So if you've got a flock of sheep, that's a lot of food. So they're willing to come your way and snag one of those sheep or goats or whatever it may be. And God says there's coming a time when the nature of animals will change and you will be able to dwell with your, shall feed their flocks and lie down, and no one shall make them afraid. That's not the way it is today, but it will be in the future. God promises that us that, and it will begin, as I said, with the change in nature in the animals and change in the condition that exists there. There will be no Satan. There will be no mindset that he offers. Now, one of the great challenges for farmers, at least this side of the flood, has been rain. When we moved to Houston back in 2011, it was 100 degrees every day that we were here up until September, and it began to break. And there hadn't been much rain all, since springtime. Very little rain, so it was dry. The reservoirs were drying up. And so we can, if you remember back to 2011, we didn't have any floods to worry about, did we? But 2017, things are different. And you think, well, couldn't we just spread that out over many years and not have to go through 50 inches in 3 or 4 days? But that's not the way it was, and that's the way it's been with mankind. It's a feast or famine kind of a thing. But in Deuteronomy, it talks about rain and talks about how God would deal with agriculture. Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 11 and begin in verse 14. Deuteronomy chapter 11, verse 14. And God, in this chapter, contrasts agriculture in the land of promise with Egypt. So what's it like in Egypt? What's it like in the land of promise? Let's begin in verse 14. He says, "Then I will give you the rain for your land in its season." You know, there's a time when, you know, if you plant your garden, it would be nice to have rain come at certain points in time that are going to be ideal for your garden to grow. And that's how farmers always are. We want the rain at the right time. And he says in verse, it goes on in verse 13, he says that, "Then I will give you the rain for your land in its season, the early rain and the latter rain, that you may gather in your grain, your new wine, and your oil." That's what God wanted to do. So the early rain, what is the first rain or the latter rain? What are these things speaking of? quoting from Barnes' notes, it says the former rain or is the proper term for the autumn rain, falling about the time of sowing, and which they may be named the former. So as occurring in the Hebrew civil year, namely in October and November. So once they got back from the feast, they would plant their fields, and they wanted the rain to come then to give their crops a good start. So it started then. The other word is applied to the spring rain, which falls in March and April. So your crops come along, it's growing, but you need more rain in order to help the crop to really come in and produce the most fruits possible. So that falls in the time of March and April, and because it fits the earth for ingathering of harvest. And between the two wet periods, there was little or no rain in Canaan. So God said, "I will give you the early and latter rain," just exactly the amounts and at the time that you need. So let's go on to verse 14. "And I will give you the rain for your land in a season, the early rain and the latter rain." And then 15, "I will send grass in your fields for your livestock, that you may eat and be filled. Take heed to yourselves, lest your heart be deceived, and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them. Lest the Lord's anger be aroused against you and be shut up, and he shut up the heavens so that there be no rain, and the land quickly, when land yield no produce, and you perish quickly from the land from which the Lord is giving you." So he said, I'm going to give you the rain at the appropriate time. If you follow me and acknowledge me as your God, I will be your God. I will walk among you and I will allow you to produce the crops that you need. You'll have the trees will grow, the grain will come in, the grapevines will produce, the olive trees will produce the olives, and there will be grass in the fields for your livestock. And God, this was going to be very different than Egypt, because God wanted them to learn to depend upon Him. So He put them in that circumstance where they would have to depend on Him. And unfortunately, they looked to Baal to give them the rains and to produce all the good fruits. And, you know, as James addresses the agricultural issues and tells us in James chapter 5, verse 7, he says, therefore, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and latter rains. So he's using a spiritual analogy to make a point with God's people. That even from God, He pours out upon us the early and latter rains in order that we can grow and we can mature and produce the most that we can. So He says, you also be patient, establishing your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. So we plant, we sow, and we need the early and latter rains in a spiritual sense. And that's what James is referring to there. Now, let's go to Zechariah chapter 14. Zechariah chapter 14. And we've talked about water. Water is a big part of successful agriculture, and that's not going to change. And God is going to make sure there's plenty of water in the future. Zechariah chapter 14, verse 8. So it speaks of the coming of Christ and his touching down on the Mount of Olives. And then in that chapter, in verse 8, it says, in that day it shall be that living water shall flow from Jerusalem. So when you look at Jerusalem today, it looks dry. There's not much water flowing there. And if you look at the Jordan River, it's not overly impressive. I mean, there's a lot of water that runs down during the rainy season, but there isn't loads of water that is flowing down the Jordan River, and a lot of times you look at it and it almost looks like a creek. It's not very impressive. But he says there's going to be water flowing from Jerusalem. And he goes on to say, half of them toward the eastern sea and half of them toward the western sea. So half of the waters are going to be headed down toward the Dead Sea, and half of the waters are going to be headed toward the Mediterranean. And he says, in both summer and winter it shall occur. There's going to be plenty of water flowing from Jerusalem, east and west. And that's a reality, a physical reality that will take place, but it's also telling us that from God is going to flow this endless river. It's never going to dry up. It's always going to be flowing, the river of life. And he says so he's telling us here that this river is going to flow in both summer and winter, and the Lord shall be king over all the earth. In that day it shall be the Lord is one and his name one. And you know, it's symbolic of the blessing God will pour out on mankind. And as you go to Ezekiel chapter 47, he talks about a river that's going to flow out of the temple. And Ezekiel chapter 47, beginning in verse 1, it says, then he brought me back to the door of the temple, and there was water flowing from under the threshold of the temple toward the east, for the front of the temple faced east. The water was flowing from under the right side of the temple, south of the altar. He brought me out by the way of the north gate and led me around the outside to the outer gateway that faces east, and there was water running out on the right side. So there's all this water coming out of the temple, flowing toward the east. So it's flowing down there, and then he begins to measure it. And as he's going out a certain distance. It's increasing in depth until he reaches the point where he can't. It's over his head. His feet can't touch the ground anymore. It's a lot of water that's going to be flowing. And what's the outcome of that in chapter 47, verse 7? When I returned there along the bank of the river were very many trees on one side and the other. Then he said to me, this water flows toward the eastern region, goes down into the valley and enters the sea. When it reaches the sea, its waters are healed. Some of you have been to Israel and have gone to Dead Sea. The Dead Sea, and it's dead because there's so much salt there. You know, you may not be able to float in a lake here, but if you go to the Dead Sea, you can float. Everybody can float, and because of all of the salt there, that'll make you buoyant. And but it says the waters are going to be healed. All of that salt that has characterized the waters there is going to be diluted. And it's going to be healed so that sea creatures and fish can dwell there. And it shall be that every living thing that moves wherever the river goes will live. There will be a very great multitude of fish because these waters go there, for they will be healed and everything will live wherever the river goes. It shall be that fishermen will stand by it from Engedi to in Eglaim, and Engedi is down at the bottom of the Jordan River, down close to the Red Sea. And they will be great places for spreading their nets. Their fish will be of the same kind as the fish of the Great Sea, exceedingly many. So if they're like the fish of the Great Sea, then they must be sea creatures that are living there that can take the salt water. And there will be an abundance of them, and you will have fishermen there who will fish. But its swamps and marshes will not be healed. They will be given over to salt. Along the bank of the river on this side and that will grow all kinds of trees used for food. Their leaves will not wither, and their fruit will not fail. They will bear much fruit every month. How many of you have trees that bear fruit every month? Some of you might. Most of us don't. That's an unusual thing. There, they will provide food. They will not wither, and their fruit will not fail. They will produce fruit every month because their water flows from the sanctuary. Their fruit will be for food and their leaves for medicine. So we'll have this abundance of fruit that's produced, and from the leaves and the crops, there will be things that you can use for a medicinal purpose. And God's telling you this will happen. And it's not going to just happen in the land of Israel, but it's going to happen all over the world as you think of what will unfold there as God brings healing to the earth. Let's go to Amos chapter 9, verse 13. Amos tells us about how abundant the crops of the age to come will be. Amos chapter 9, verse 13. Verse 13 says, "Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, when the plowman shall overtake the reaper." How often does that happen? The plowman, they're beginning to plow the fields, and they're still bringing in the crops. That doesn't happen much in our day. But there is coming a time when the plowman shall overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes him who sows seed. The mountains shall drip with sweet wine, and all the hills shall flow with it. So there is a coming time of abundance. Abundance for everybody. Not just a few. It will be distributed to all, and all will be able to enjoy it. All of the wonderful things that can be produced from the field. You know, God calls what we just got back from the feast. And what's a big part of the feast? It's feasting. I know when we lived in Ohio, my son was in school, and he would say, "I'm going away to the feast." And one of his friends really didn't feast. All he knew that a feast was eating a lot. So he called it the big dinner. He said he's going away to the big dinner. And in a certain sense, it is. It's a chance to get together with people and enjoy a meal, to enjoy the opportunity to get together. We ate a big meal with the brethren last Monday. We celebrated Canadian Thanksgiving, so they had the same types of foods that we're used to on Thanksgiving. So we just felt it's a warm-up for American Thanksgiving. So we stretched our stomachs out a little bit, and we'll look forward to Thanksgiving here in November. But he talks about all of the fruits and the wonderful things that will be produced at that time. And he tells us in the book of Ezekiel, it's going to be like the Garden of Eden. I look forward. You know, I've never seen the Garden of Eden. I can imagine it. But it's going to be like the Garden of Eden throughout the whole earth. That's what God wanted from the beginning. God wanted man to be in the garden and to follow him and eat of the tree of life and expand the Garden of Eden until it encompassed the whole earth. And that whole opportunity they failed epically in fulfilling God's purpose for them. But that's what God wanted. So God didn't give up. God just said, okay, we'll put this off for a time. But there is a time when this is going to happen. There is a time when this is going to come about. And that with Christ's return, the whole earth will be like the Garden of Eden. I can only imagine what that's going to be like. The trees and the plants and all of the beautiful things that will be there. And all of the fruits that will be available to all. It will be a most wonderful time. Let's look at a couple of verses here. And then one final thought here about, you know, one of the problems that we face in the world today is a lot of the world is desert. You can't grow crops there. You know, if you fly from California back to the east or vice versa, and you look out your window in certain portions of that flight, you will notice that large sections of the middle of the country are wastelands. There's nothing out there. And sometimes when you get out in that wasteland, you'll look out your window and you'll see this circle of green. Well, the only reason that circle of green is there is because they're able to irrigate and produce whatever crops they're producing. But beyond that, it's all pretty much a wasteland. There's large portions of the earth that are desert and difficult to live in. And God said that's going to come to an end. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 35. Isaiah chapter 35. There's coming a time when large sections of desert will no longer be desert. Isaiah chapter 35, beginning in verse 1. It says, "The wilderness and the wasteland shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice, even with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the excellence of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of the Lord, the excellency of our God." There's going to be a blossoming of the desert. And if you've ever been out in the desert when there's a torrent of rain, it rains and then the desert does blossom. But then the heat comes right back and it doesn't last long. But God said, there's going to be water boiling up here. And that water is going to make this land begin to really produce. Let's go down to verse 6. Verse 6 of Isaiah 35. "Then the lame shall leap like a deer and the tongue of the dumb sing." You know, we have individuals that can't walk and they're going to be able to walk. People that can't speak that are going to be able to speak. They will be healed. "For the water shall burst forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. The parched ground shall become a pool and the thirsty land springs of water and the habitation of jackals where each lay. There shall be grass with reeds and rushes." Territories where you couldn't grow anything, water is going to boil up and you're going to be able to plant crops. You're going to be able to establish places to live. And you're going to be able to enjoy all the blessings and benefits from God's way of life. And God tells us that that is going to come. That he's going to use all of the waste places and expand. You know, people say, well, the earth can't hold all these people. You know, think about the second resurrection. You know, maybe you're going to have billions of people. We've got seven here, and we've got too many people. We need to get rid of people. God said, it's all going to be fine. Because when my kingdom comes, everybody's going to have a place. Everybody. Everybody's going to have a place. And more than anything, God is going to, all of these things symbolize the great spiritual fruits that will be born as and make it possible for people to be born into the kingdom of God forever. Now, I mentioned earlier what happens if people lose the land that's been allotted to them. Because I think some of that will happen because people are still going to learn lessons. And sometimes you only learn lessons through adversity. So people can suffer crop failure, people can have, and you say, well, it's going to be perfect. God's going to allow some challenges in the system because we need the challenges. You know, if we're just laying around all day long, going out and picking some fruit, when, you know, that's, we're not going to learn anything through that. So you're going to have to plant your crops, you're going to have to do the various things that are productive. Yeah, so that we can learn things. So it seems like there will be some bad times that will come upon people. So let's say you lose your land for some reason. Maybe it's beyond your control, but you lose it. God said there's going to come a time when your land will be returned. And he also tells us something interesting here that will happen in regard to the land Sabbath. Not only will they keep the weekly Sabbath, but they'll also keep the land Sabbath. Look at Leviticus chapter 25. It says, the Lord spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, saying, this is in verse 1, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I give you, then the land shall keep a Sabbath to the Lord. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather its fruit. But in the 7th year there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall neither sow your field nor prune your vineyard. So that means for 6 years you're going to work the land. The 7th year, you have the year off. You're not going to work in your field. You're not going to do any of that. And that's not something that, and people think, well, this couldn't possibly work. But God said, if you will honor me and worship me and seek me, this will work. And you'll have a year in which you can focus on what is your primary responsibility and primary priority. I'm going to make this work out. So you're going to neither sow your field nor prune your vineyard. Not going to be doing any of your farm work. You've got the year off. What grows of its own accord of your harvest you shall not reap, nor gather the grapes of your untended vine, for it is a year of rest for the land. It's not only a year of rest for the land, but it's a year of rest for you. And then he says, for you, your male and female servants, your hired man and stranger who dwells with you, for your livestock and the beasts that are in your land, all its produce shall be for food. So you can eat what it produces on its own, but you're not going to plant and you're not going to do all of your farm work. Verse 18 of chapter 25, it says, so you shall observe my statutes and keep my judgments and perform them, and you shall dwell in the land in safety. Then the land will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and dwell there in safety. And just like most of us, they had the question, well, okay, that's good, God, but how's this going to really work? Are you really going to provide for us? And what does he say in verse 20? He says, and if you say, what shall we eat in the 7th year? Since we shall not sow nor gather in our produce. So what are we going to eat? And God says, then I will command my blessing on you in the 6th year. I will command my blessing on you in the 6th year, and it will bring forth produce enough for 3 years. So in the 6th year, you're going to have enough produce for the 6th year, the 7th year, and the 8th year. Because the 6th year, you'll bring in the crop. The 7th year, you're not going to plant. So when you plant at the end of the 7th year for the 8th, you're still not going to have any produce. So God's going to have to bless you in that 6th year to carry you on through till the harvest comes in. And God promises that that's going to be the case. Trust me, he says. You'll produce enough for 3 years, and you shall sow in the eighth year and eat old produce until the ninth, until its produce comes in. You shall eat of the old harvest. Is that walking by faith? I think so. You're going to trust God that He's going to come through? I think so. Would the temptation be there for people to plant in the seventh year and the eighth year? Sure. But God said, don't do that. Trust me. This will work out. So we've discussed agriculture during the millennial reign of Christ and the saints. And is God only interested in good crops and prosperity? No, He's not. All of that is symbolic of something much greater. God's not interested in grapes so much. God's not interested in wheat or cucumbers or whatever we produce in the field. God is interested in something much bigger and something much better. God's more interested in things spiritual. We find in 1 Corinthians 3, verse 5, it says, who then is Paul? Who then is Apollos? But ministers through whom you believed as the Lord gave to each one. Paul and Apollos were God's servants. And through them, God sowed spiritual seed. The seed of the gospel. Chapter 3, verse 6, 1 Corinthians 3, verse 6. Paul says, I planted the seed, and Apollos watered. He gave some of the water on them, but God gave the increase. They were both involved as God's servants, but they both gave. God gave the increase. It wasn't them. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 7. So then neither he who plants is anything, nor he who waters, but God who gives the increase. So it's not human beings. It's God working through those human beings and producing the fruits of eternal life. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 8. Now he who plants and he who waters are one, and each one will receive his own reward according to his own labor. Chapter 3, verse 9. For we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field. You are God's building. We are God's field. We are His crops. And He is looking to see us produce the greatest fruits that have ever been produced. Exceeding any grapes or any physical harvest, what He's looking for are the fruits of the Spirit. That's the great harvest. People who are living God's way and producing spiritual fruits. That's what it's really all about. And all of those physical things are wonderful things, but they're all pointing to the working out of the spiritual things. You know, the river that boils up in the desert and allows that desert to become green and to produce crops, that's pointing to God's Spirit leading and guiding us. And God said that He's going to bring that all about. And all of the symbols we see point to that. Let's go to final scripture, Hosea 14. Hosea 14, beginning in verse 1. Hosea 14, beginning in verse 1. It says, O Israel, return to the Lord your God, for you have stumbled because of your iniquity. And that's what God wants all of us to do, to repent and turn to Him. He says in verse 2, take words with you and return to the Lord. Say to Him, take away all iniquity. Receive us graciously, for we will offer the sacrifice of our lips. Assyria will not save us. You know, some other nation can't save you. We will not ride on horses, so we aren't going to have cavalry or anything else that's going to save us. Nor shall we say any more to the work of our hands, you are our gods, for in you the fatherless finds mercy. We don't find God's mercy in idols, but we find it in God Himself. He says, I will heal their backsliding. I will love them freely, for my anger has turned away from him. I will be like the dew to Israel. And the dew was crucial to crops growing in the land of Israel. The dew was heavy in certain times of the year and helped to produce the grass and the crops. He shall grow like the lily and lengthen his roots like Lebanon. His branches shall spread. His beauty shall be like an olive tree and his fragrance like Lebanon, like the cedars of Lebanon. And if you've ever been around pine trees, there's a wonderful fragrance that you can enjoy as you're near those trees. Those who dwell under his shadow shall return. They shall be revived like grain and grow like a vine. Their scent shall be like the wine of Lebanon. God is going to allow spiritual fruits to be produced. He's allowing them to be produced now, and they will especially be produced when Christ returns and sets up his kingdom. So when you think about millennial agriculture, it may seem like I'm really not interested in that. I'm interested in computers or some other facet of life. But, you know, there's a lot in the Bible, and it's in there for a reason. It is in there to give us the encouragement and a glimpse of what God is going to work out and that we can all be a part of. And we have the chance right now to bear the fruits of the Spirit. And that's what God is really interested in, that we would bear those fruits because they are a type of the fruits that will be born in God's kingdom. So thanks for your attention. Hopefully you found this profitable, and you'll take it home, and along with the other things that you've heard from the feast, take them and apply them and use them as a springboard to your growth throughout the coming year.